funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does scent shape the way we perceive the world? With olfactory abilities that are far less keen than other animals, we humans sometimes dismiss smell as a sort of second-class sense. Yet the extraordinarily complex odors given off by places and things have a significant impact on our experiences, memories, and emotions, even when we are not paying them much conscious attention. And as my guest today will tell us, the quest to isolate and duplicate the fragrance of real life continues to evade even the world's most talented noses. Journalist Beau Friedlander is author of the article A Brief History of Scent. You can find it in the August issue of Harper's Magazine. Beau, welcome to Think.
Oh, thanks for having me, Chris.
So you open the piece with an exploration of what might be the worst odor imaginable, the smell of death. And it seems odd that anybody would want to reproduce that, but it turns out that we might be able to protect military troops from trauma by conditioning them to those smells before they arrive on the battlefield.
Right. Yeah, several years ago there was an incident in Georgia where a crematory had failed to cremate anybody for a long time. And when it was discovered, it was indescribably horrible. A researcher at the Monell Institute in Philadelphia realized that that was going to provide a key part of a training program to help soldiers get ready for war.
And the way that works is essentially they can be exposed to things that they might smell at very traumatic moments.
Well, I've never been in a war theater, but in a war theater, if you're being exposed to a trauma in the form of the warfare you're experiencing, and on top of that, the smells for the first time ever are happening to you, whether that's the smell of death or the smell of cordite from a bomb or all of those things happening at the same time, you're not going to be very well equipped to handle any of it. And the idea was to at least expose soldiers to the smells that they were going to experience in the war theater before they got there, so that their first association with it wasn't war. It was actually in a well-lighted room watching war simulations, really disconnected from the experience.
Why is there such a relationship between odor and strong emotion?
I don't think anyone really knows that. I mean, throughout the history of literature, Proust probably most famously had that reminiscence about Madeleine, the Madeleine cookie, that triggered a whole episode from his childhood. I think that it's the brain itself actually developed out of the mucosa, the olfactory mucosa. The first part of our brain was the part of our brain that smelled.
And I guess it would make sense that we are particularly likely to form connections between negative emotions and odors because from an evolutionary standpoint, it makes sense that we want to permanently avoid things that we associate with danger and fear.
Right. I mean, I think first of all, the olfactory mucosa is the only place in our body that comes in direct contact with the outside world, the only part of our central nervous system that comes in direct contact with the outside world. It's our advanced warning system. It tells us when something is dangerous. So we're hardwired to react to things that could cause harm to us. And often, bad smells carry really bad news in the form of pathogens and other things that can kill us.
Yeah, and in fact, before we really understood anything about germs, the sort of working theory was that, bad air was the problem.
Yeah, they called it miasmas in the 18th century. And there were all kinds of programs to create antimephitics these were compounds designed to kill a miasma. In the article, I recount a story from Paris in Alain Corbin's book. He talked about it in that book, where Rochefoucauld and Lavoisier and several scientists at the time gathered around a famous cesspool where medical students were discarding body parts after they'd been experimenting on them. And the stench was just legendary. And someone fell in during this experiment and died on the spot. But what they didn't understand then was that the smell didn't kill them. It was what was producing the smell and the other pathogens that existed in the same place.
It's interesting, though, even now, I mean, a lot of really strong-smelling chemicals are known to be carcinogenic.
Yeah, I think that our bodies and often know better than we do what to get away from, and that's, you know, that nose wrinkler that we experience in the street, whether it's or anywhere, whether it's the smell of exhaust from a car or a chemical. I think our bodies actually really do know when something's wrong, and by the same token, that's how a lot of materia medica, you know, things that have turned into the foundation parts of medicine, that's how they were discovered, because the opposite, they smelled good.
You write here about the origins of the tradition of bringing flowers to a funeral. And initially, I guess it was not about comforting the bereaved, but about masking the smell of death.
I think that's up for grabs historically, but yes, there's certainly a theory out there or an explanation, better, that especially since lilies are really associated with funerals, and lilies are really aromatic, so they would cover the smell of decomposition.
And yet it turns out that some of the very worst experiences of bad smells are the ones in which something we rather like is mixed in with the thing we find unbearable.
Oh, you're talking about stench soup.
Yeah.
Well, stench soup was actually a non-lethal bioweapon produced by the Monell Institute, again, for the U.S. military. And the idea was to create something that would clear an area. So if there was a riot or any situation where they just wanted to get rid of everybody without killing them, they would release this substance, and it was so unbearable no one could stay on the site. And it was made, they had a proprietary smell of human feces that this lab made, which was revolting, and they created a vomit smell, which was also revolting. But what made it particularly unbearable was when they added a fruity or a floral note, just something nice lying on top of that sort of olfactory atrocity was what really did people in.
And I wonder if that has to do with the fact that we're trying to make sense of this thing, and so we inhale deeply, and it causes us to take in more of that scent that we can't stand.
Yeah, I wonder that too. I think that's the only thing that makes sense, right? You're smelling something, and your brain is doing somersaults trying to get away from that scent, and then another part of it says, "But wait, what's that?" And so it inhales even more, and the revolting part takes over. When they tested it, actually, they had the subject sit in a room with a dial, so they could dial up the stench soup, or dial it down. And in another test, and you know, they there was a very low threshold for people. I got a sample of it. I couldn't smell it for more than a half a second.
And you opened this in your apartment, is that right?
No, I didn't. My wife would have killed me. I didn't. I went downstairs, and a neighbor of mine who is an adventurous soul and I went out into the alley and opened it. And when we opened it quickly and took a quick whiff, and both of us had a really strong reaction. But we'd been told to expect vomiting if we smelled it. Hmm. Neither of us did vomit, which was good. And then I looked down the street, and I could have sworn, as I looked down to the street through the alley, and I could have sworn there was a guy. He looked up like, "What? What on earth is in there?" And so it was pretty horrific.
How did you get interested in this, Bo?
You know, I think it dates pretty far back, and it's a little highfalutin. When I was in college, I studied literature, and I became super interested in physics, actually Heisenberg and that whole crew, and the way that they talked about indeterminacy was really appealing to me, because I thought it really spoke to an aesthetic situation, you know, an interesting aesthetic situation where this penumbra where things don't necessarily mean one thing, they can mean many things or whatever. And I've always gravitated to things that are hard to describe or explain, and scent is, it really beggars description a lot of the time. It's very difficult to say, well, what happens when you smell something? What does it mean? Hmm. I mean, and it's so subjective too. It's like trying to describe pain.
Yeah.
It, 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 It's very individual. I find it fascinating.
Well, it is interesting, you know, and you speak briefly in the piece about the, you know, the ridiculous terms that are used to describe fragrances that are sold commercially. But everybody knows what a rose smells like, but it's impossible to define that to someone who has never smelled a rose.
Right. And can you imagine, there are people who are born without the ability to smell.
Mm-hmm.
And while they'd be great for treating miasmas in the 19th century and the 18th century, they really are, if you think about it, they're really imperiled all the time, right? Because they won't smell when something's wrong.
You know, I had a friend once who couldn't smell, and his feeling about it was that people were constantly talking about things they couldn't stand the smell of, so he didn't know how much he was missing. Of course, he was worried, you know, that if there was smoke in his house, he wouldn't notice it or that sort of thing. But it is funny that we get much more emotional about the things we don't like.
I think, well, I also have a friend who can't smell, and his position was always... Was always kind of self-congratulatory.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a handicap at all. He didn't have to smell any of the horrible things that we were constantly complaining about.
Right.
But on the other side of that, one of the things that I found as I wrote the essay was a lot of what happened with scent after we buried our sewers and created methods for treating public stench. One of the things that really comes up is this is about coping with smells that are out there. And that guy never had to learn how to cope with any smells. But the bigger point, actually, is that nowadays, with the exception of days, like I understand it's over 100 degrees in Dallas today,
mm-hmm.
Well, if you walk by a garbage truck, chances are it's going to smell worse than it possibly could any other time of year, because the hot air speeds up the molecules and makes everything worse.
Right.
However, really, day-to-day existence in modern society, we've learned how to cope with malodors so much that they're really a non-issue. So it doesn't matter if you can smell, because the chances of you walking into a room that has a gas leak where there's no one else who can help you are probably pretty small.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time, we're using smell to do exactly what you just said, you know, like someone didn't take a shower, or somebody didn't take out the garbage, or the dog did something it shouldn't have done. And my friend who can't smell thinks it's fantastic he can't smell, because none of those things really matter.
And yet, you know, since we have eliminated, as you say, you know, public odors in most cases, in the developed world, things are a little bit different where people are much poorer, obviously. But we're hypersensitive as well to things that may not have bothered our ancestors 100 years ago, may not have struck them as blatantly offensive in the way that many smells affect us now.
Right, like body odor, for example. I agree. I mean, but, you know, there's still, that also, I think, even within our culture, I was really struck by what I learned about scent branding when I was reporting this piece. There's, if you have enough dough and you don't want to smell anything, man, you not only can you get rid of any smells you don't want to smell, but you can make your life smell like anything you want. and literally, there are companies out there that will make your life smell a particular way, and everything, every aspect of it. So it does sort of, even in the United States, which, you know, has a more homogenous lay of the land, I think that there's definitely a class in smell or a socioeconomic in smell sort of cast with an E on the end out there. And if you go around the world, sure, there are places where people, you know, body odor is not considered at all offensive. And it seems even strange that you would cover it up with some strange, you know, smell of wood or whatever it is we do with our various deodorant smells.
My guest is journalist Beau Friedlander. His article, A Brief History of Scent, appears in the August issue of Harper's Magazine. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Beau Friedlander. His new book, his new article in the August issue of Harper's Magazine is called A Brief History of Scent. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So I want to talk a little bit more about this scent branding industry that you alluded to a few minutes ago. There's this company that's sort of the leader of things. They're sort of like the Muzak of smells?
Yeah, well, they are not sort of like the Muzak of smells. Muzak owns them. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was fantastic because, I mean, How it couldn't be more perfect.
Right.
So Muzak has always, I mean, since I was a kid anyway, pumped music into public spaces to create calm, to create a mood, and to often with retail, right, to get people ready to buy something or to relax them enough to not think about what they shouldn't buy. And Scentair does exactly the same thing. So we're now seeing this company has produced different smells for Westin, hotels, the Mandarin Oriental, and their strategies behind it are fascinating.
So what do they have to think about? Because, of course, there are things that, you know, if I bought cologne, you might think it was horrible and I might think it was delightful.
Well, that's just a subjective thing. I'm always fascinated by, you know, the bottom line of not liking a scent, like if you walk up to somebody and they smell, they have something on that just makes you want to retch. If you go into a department store, and a big department store where they have a lot of perfume counters on the bottom floor, often you'll find that, at least here in the city at Macy's, for example.
Mm-hmm.
When you walk in, you're hit hard with probably hundreds of different perfumes. And if you were to throw them all together, actually a perfumer did that. It took every single, I think, the top 100 best-selling perfumes and made a perfume out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, it's probably smelled like something that would kill you. The fact of the matter is it might, too, because a lot of the chemicals used in perfume are probably not the most friendly things. There's perfumers like Mandy Aftel out there who does who makes perfumes that are completely natural. But the things that you buy at a department store, for the most part, are pretty artificial, and probably your nose is right to run when it smells that tangle at the department store.
So what does Scentair, this Muzak derivative, what kinds of fragrance is it adding to the air?
Well, tons. So there's different strategies that they'll offer you as a client. There's the billboard, there's the thematic strategy, there's the ambient strategy, and there's the branding strategy.
Hmm.
Now, a billboard is just what it sounds like. You walk in, they're selling an orange blossom scent, and that's all you can smell. So it used to be, and I'm not sure if it's the case anymore, but I used to walk by one of the body shop stores,
mm-hmm,
in Manhattan, and it was, if it had been music, it would be blaring. It was blaring this odorant, and it was an orange kind of smell. But you couldn't pay me to go in. That's a billboard scent. There's a chocolate shop in my neighborhood in Williamsburg called Mast Brothers. I have a child who finds chocolate to be the most abhorrent thing on earth.
Hmm.
And when we walk by, she retches.
Huh.
They have a billboard scent. It's not, probably, it's intentional. They probably have their vents pointed at the street. So when they're making chocolate, it smells like chocolate, mm-hmm, on the street. That's a billboard scent. A thematic scent is when you walk into a place, or usually a hotel or a chain like Victoria's Secret, and they all smell exactly the same. Ambient is similar. Ambient could be anywhere. You could decide that you want your studio to smell like a pine forest, and that could be done for you.
All right, go ahead, continue.
And then they just keep going down. The most fascinating one, very quickly, recently, that I read about was Rolls-Royce. The new Rolls-Royces, they're super expensive cars. Now, people were getting into these super expensive cars that they were buying and thinking that, you know, it just smells like a car. It doesn't smell special, and because really it is just a car. But Rolls-Royce was getting this as feedback. So they went and they took 800 samples from the rubber seals to the wood to the lacquer to the leather to the carpeting to everything in a 1965 Silver Cloud Rolls-Royce. 800 samples, and they went to a lab and they made that smell, and now they put it under the seat of new Rolls-Royces. So when you get into the new Rolls-Royce, it doesn't smell like a car. It smells like a Rolls-Royce. So that would be branding. Hmm. And that's the last kind of work that Centair is engaged in.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Marcos in Dallas. Hey, Marcos.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Great, thank you.
You know, really interesting topic, and I just never really thought about scent that much. And now that I'm listening to your program, it reminds me of my brother, who's a police officer, and oftentimes he would come home and he would tell me stories about his job. And just about, now that I'm thinking about it, listening to your program, every time he had a story, it had to do with scent. And his first clue to just about everything was scent. He would tell me that they would get a report about a home, and the minute they cracked the window, they knew there would be a dead body in there. Obviously, when he pulled over cars, there would be the smell of drugs or marijuana, or maybe someone's breath that they've been drinking that night. And it's almost like a defense mechanism for him in his job. The smell was always the first clue that he needed to go further or defend himself.
That is really fascinating, Marcos. Thank you so much for your call. What do you think about that, Bo?
It's a great point. I mean, I was while he was talking, I was just realizing that both of our friends would never get a job as a cop, because they'd be really, really they wouldn't have any chance at catching that rotten driver who is smoking marijuana in his car. It makes sense to me that scent would play a huge part in law enforcement. And there's dogs who do it, and I guess cops do it too.
So there are a million, there have to be, I've bought at least 100,000 candles and sprays and things like that are supposed to smell like spring rain, or they're supposed to smell like a forest or whatever. And they never smell anything like that actual thing. Why is it so hard to recreate something in nature that is sort of complex and mellow and not overwhelming?
Well, I mean, therein lies a really... That's the whole latter half of the essay in Harper's. The attempts to reproduce things from nature have been pretty abysmal, and part of it is that there's no market for it. Even though I too have bought those candles, but if you think about the little trees deodorant that you can put in your car that smells like, well, they smell like 100 million different things now. Mm-hmm. You can get the smell of anything. But it started when I was a kid as a pine tree.
Right.
And it smelled like pine. And it didn't smell at all like pine. It smelled like a cartoon version of a pine tree. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because when it comes to the subjective experience of smelling something, they really do need to find the lowest common denominator, because we all have to be able to say that's pine.
Right.
Not that's pine, that's not a white pine or a Douglas fir, or that's a Douglas fir after rain, or that's a Douglas fir in the summertime when it's hot and the resin is seeping out of the bark of the tree. So there's so many variables in nature, in particular discrete nature, the woods, specific place, your feet on the ground, in duff, with, you know, the factors are really endless, and so to create a smell to do that is a huge task.
And we can all, I suppose, some of those things that are wrapped up in very natural scents that we find appealing, if we were to isolate them, are not appealing at all, but they're part of the whole package.
Yeah, I when I was researching this, a part that didn't get into the essay that was fascinating, but it really, I interviewed two people who were very interesting when it came to recreating the smell of a place. And one was Christopher Brocious in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where I live. He's a perfumer. And one was Roman Kaiser from Givaudan. And in this instance, Roman Kaiser had the more interesting story to tell because it was the work that he did for a living. But Christopher made he sat down and made for me the smell of a pond. And what it was really interesting, because we sat down and he said, tell me about the place. And I said, well, it's a pond that I used to fish in as a kid in Connecticut. And he said, well, tell, you know, what about it? And I described there was a hill. The hill had pine on it. It ran off. There was a spillway. The spillway was filled with algae. We talked about it for a while, and he created something. Now, it smelled a little bit like a pond. It didn't. It was the little pines, pine smell, though. It was a pond, sort of generic pond. But in it was the smell of wet wool. There was the smell of soil, geosmin. It's called geosmin. The smell of really wet, dark earth. There was a smell of pine. There were probably 20 or 30 constituent odors in there to create the overall smell.
And just, you know, I was thinking about the job of people who have to go and try to, you know, find new scents and isolate them. And you can go out there, and I suppose if you, it's almost like having perfect pitch for the nose, right? Because you can't take a photograph when you're out there in nature trying to experience something. And you can write down some notes, but you can't capture the scent of a place and bring it back and then breathe it again in the lab.
I always wonder about that, because there's certain smells, especially the cartoony ones, mm-hmm. in candy. You know, because the flavor industry and the fragrance industry are very tied together. And, you know, when you bite down, when you get one of those pear scent, you know, flavored candies that have that strong pear smell, I sometimes get confused. I don't know what I'm supposed to be thinking. And there are people out there who can smell a substance in a perfume, even, like Christopher Brocious and Roman Kaiser and a lot of it, Luca Turin comes to mind, who can tell you pretty much to really closely what's in there and reproduce it. And if they were to put it into a gas spectrometer, they could reproduce it exactly.
Do they feel like their abilities are genetic? Do they feel like it's just years of practice?
You know, it's funny. I got the impression that I might as well be sitting next to Yasha Heifetz, the violinist. Or it's Yitzhak Perlman, whoever, mm-hmm. you know, a real maestro.
Yeah.
That they just, this particular capacity in them was so far beyond anything that I could imagine. And it's interesting because it's so subjective. It really was beyond anything I could imagine. I mean, so the humans have six to 8 million olfactory receptors. And so compare that to a dog, not any dog, but average is about 200 million receptors. So it's 8 million versus 200 million receptors. And that's why when your dog is upstairs, if you have a dog or your cat, and you open something that they like, they'll come from 20, 30 feet away, and they'll come pretty quickly. Because they're experiencing things that are just totally beyond your ken.
Yeah, my dog can be in the backyard and know that we've ordered pizza.
Yeah, well, that's kind of scary.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go back to the phones now. We have Paul on the line in Dallas. Hey, Paul.
Hi. Hey, we know, or at least I have heard over and over, that the a female being around a male actually affects her cycle, and that male pungency turns on the male. But my main question is, especially I gather of the artificial odors that pine tree in the car and such, and perfumes that women wear, for instance, which I find by and large abominable. That they do have often toxins in them, but as to odor, that they have hormones in that mimic estrogen.
Well, let's find out about that. I think pheromones and that sort of thing are something, Bo, that people have talked about for a long time in fragrance.
Yeah, first of all, fascinating point, and another riddle for people, scientists, and you and I included. Pheromones are odorless. So the question is, in this research, I came across somebody who had done some research into the possibility that when we kiss, we're able to sense pheromones, probably through the olfactory mucosa. even though they're odorless, and that those pheromones are conveying information about a potential partner for reproduction. In other words, we're smelling DNA, and that's where that attraction comes from. The research into pheromones, there's a lot of companies that claim they're making pheromones, liquid pheromones, but really, you know, a lot of what people are thinking are the smell of pheromones is really the smell of what transpires between a man and a woman who consent and are in a quiet place together. In other words, their odors associated with the body. Now, one smell that really evokes that is pepper, and cumin is another one, which will smell a bit like sweat. If you mix that with a fruity, unlike stench soup, if you mix those odors with a citrus note, they can be very appealing, and a man will or a woman will swear that they're being wooed by a pheromone attack, when in fact it's really just an olfactory ruse. It's another one of these olfactory tactics that we have come upon over the years of having gone from learning how to cope with malodors to taking those coping skills and making an art out of them.
We have an email here from Sam in Fort Worth who says, I went to a college in a town with cold, wet winters. The smell of wet wool drying on a hot surface like a radiator snaps me back to a specific classroom in late afternoon. Sam wants to know where you went to college, Bo, and what odor would bring you back to that experience. We're about to take a break here, so I'll give you a chance to think about that, maybe come up with an answer. We're speaking this hour with journalist Bo Friedlander. He has an article in the August issue of Harper's Magazine called A Brief History of Scent. If you'd like to share a scent memory or ask a question, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking with journalist Bo Friedlander about A Brief History of Scent, his article in the August issue of Harper's. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org, which is what Sam in Fort Worth did before the break, Bo, and he was curious about what would take you back to college.
Well, in graduate school, sad to say, the smell was probably car exhaust and whiskey. I went to school at Columbia. But for undergraduate, I was in Vermont. I went to Bennington College. And I think I had really similar associations. Wool, and wet wool, and wet wool on a radiator. As a matter of fact, sometimes when I smell wet wool, I go into that synesthesia, sound really is kind of like odor in that it's equally difficult to describe sometimes, a little easier than odor. I can hear the steam knocking through the pipes of the radiator when I smell that smell.
Yeah. Yeah, I spent my pre-adolescent childhood in the Northeast, and when I think about winter, I think about the smell of wet mittens and that outside kind of the sun's almost about to set. Scent of snow, and then everybody's mom was always doing laundry, and so the dryer vents would be out into the yards, and on top of all of that outdoor snow smell, you would smell like, I don't know, whatever kind of fabric softener people were using.
Yeah, no, that's you just actually completely brought me there. I remember that entirely.
Yeah.
The interesting thing about snow is it doesn't. I think it has a smell too, but it really doesn't because it's cold, really cold.
Mm-hmm.
And when molecules get cold, they move very slowly. And the more slowly they're moving, the less you're going to be smelling, which is why garbage doesn't smell so bad in the wintertime when it's outside.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Josh in Richardson. Hi, Josh.
Hey, really interesting subject. And your author mentioned Luca Turin, who I read the book when I was doing some research for making scented candles, and it was really, really fascinating. And two things. One, I found, and I think I have a pretty good nose when it comes to scents. I found that when I tried to use more than three scents together to make for one candle, that the scents tended to get kind of muddy and soupy, like he was talking about earlier. And if I used fewer, then it just wasn't terribly interesting. And I'm wondering if there's a certain point in the brain that and he was talking a little bit that stench soup earlier, a little bit about this. If your brain gets confused, if there are too many scents together, and not necessarily conflicting scents. And the other thing that I remember from my research that I thought was interesting, and it goes along with talking about the corpses and all that, those kinds of scents and bad scents, and how we learn that is, if I remember correctly, a scent molecule called indoles, I think is what it's called, that supposedly a tiny little bit is added to pretty much every perfume, and the theory was that it will register on a subconscious level as opposed to a conscious level. And if I remember correctly, indoles are actually a scent that is associated with waste, which I thought was kind of interesting also, especially if your author can confirm that it's true.
Well, thanks for your call, Josh. We'll see about that.
Well, yes, indoles are indoles are what make you smell feces. They don't make you, but that's what you're smelling. And however, if you take a small amount of indoles, you get a flower note, which there's a joke in there somewhere. But the fact is, that is true. So the reason isn't to remind people of anything gross. It's actually because it creates a nice floral note. And, I mean, on the same note, pun intended, I guess, civet is a common note in perfume, and that actually is expressed from anal glands of the civet cat. Not anymore, because it's kind of mean to chase cats around and do that, so they've figured out a way to make them synthetically. But that's originally where that scent came from, was from the hindquarters of a cat. The Luca Turin, now, interesting thing about how those scents are getting muddy, you know, Roman Kaiser, who did help me create the smell of a place, specifically on the Mediterranean, he went through the hierarchy of smells that you would have to isolate and figure out how to reproduce to create the smell of a place. Any perfume has head notes, heart notes, and base notes. The head notes are small molecules that move very quickly, and they dissipate very quickly. So if you put a perfume on and you really like the way it smells the first 5, 10, 15 minutes, you're smelling the head notes. The heart notes are heavier molecules. They move a little slower. They don't dissipate as fast. You'll smell those too. But when you first spray the perfume, you're going to be smelling the head notes, the heart notes, and the base notes all at the same time. Now, at the end of the day, on your clothes 3 days later, you're going to smell the base notes. And the base notes are the big, heavy wood, often wood. They're these heavy molecules that'll stick on you for a really long time. So the trick for not getting a muddy scent, I think, and I'm no perfumer, would be to figuring out how you're composing your head, your heart, and your base notes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Stephen in Dallas. Hey, Stephen.
Hey there. Great show, Chris, as always.
Thank you.
I have more of an observation, and the screener helped me sort of frame it as sensory recall. And I have three scents that bring back great memories. My aunt's house, and I can't remember the second one, but the third one was the first day of school. And as a student, that had a different, evoked a different feeling. But as a teacher, and I'm no longer a teacher, it evoked a much different feeling, maybe more of anxiety. So I just wanted to toss that out there.
What does the first day of school smell like, Stephen?
Well, pine saw. So I'll let y'all go.
Thanks for your call. Did you collect, as you went around researching all of this, did you talk to friends about memories that they had and sensory recall of smells?
You know, I did a little bit, but what I did more was I collected smells.
Hmm.
And so I had amassed at some point, I think, well over 300 different samples of perfume and then some base elements, too, of what perfumes were made out of. And that really fascinated me. There was a point where my wife at the time, we're since separated, but she this is not why we got a divorce, but I would chase her around the apartment or sneak up behind her because her ankle didn't yet have something on it, and I'd give it a quick spray. And it was pretty comical, but I had a lot. I was really interested in smelling different things that were out there, and then seeing what they smelled like in different things, skin, fabric. I really became a bit of a mad scientist. So that's what I collected was smells.
I really liked the article because it made me think about all the scents that I just don't pay attention to that are out there that aren't necessarily unpleasant. I once had a roommate who had been raised on a cattle ranch, and for her, the smell of manure was actually, it was very homey, it was comforting. I didn't particularly like it, but it made me realize that there, like for all of us, there are things we associate with familiar places.
Yeah, I was thinking when Stephen was talking about school, that's a really particular smell. And I still to this day, I remember when I first took my kids to their elementary school, it was kind of the same smell.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the same school. It was in a different state, but the smell was of the smell of paper, which is a vanillin smell, and I think floor wax.
Floor
that's
wax,
the smell,
yeah.
I think.
Chalk dust.
Chalk dust, yeah, chalk dust. I mean, all that stuff, and boy, it does bring back a lot of memories.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Carrie on the line next in Dallas. Hi, Carrie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 14-year-old son who has always had a remarkable scent memory. And even since he was very young, he would say, oh, this smells like, you know, grandma's house, or this smells like the banana at the skating rink. And it's real scent specific.
Hmm.
And ever since he was really little, he would always pick things up and smell them, so much so that it was a little bit embarrassing. Like, we'd have to say when you went to other people's homes, don't pick something up and smell it. And he has a lot of learning differences.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always looking for what are his gifts, because now in eighth grade they're going to have a career fair, and there's not going to be something like, oh, maybe you could help develop perfumes, you know. Like, I'm just trying to figure out, is there something I could be doing as a mom who has a son who I really think is gifted in this way, develop his scent and or his abilities? And is this a unique thing, or is this pretty common?
That's an interesting question, Carrie. Thanks.
I don't know what you would do, but I think that it is. Well, first of all, I don't think I know. It's super unique to have the ability to put words to smells, and to really have strong discernment with regard to what you're smelling is even more unusual. So, you know, I guess there's a potential career there for your child.
So as a writer, were you sort of offended by the cheesy descriptions of fragrances that you found when you were at this scent collection phase of the research for this piece?
Well, I know you're referring to something I wrote in the essay, and I was rather mean about a couple of perfumers. I think Tom Ford was definitely a recipient of some snarkiness on my part. Yeah, I mean, they're sort of the way they're described is like they're like Harlequin romance. Now they're bodice rippers, you know. Oh, you know, it's the smell of, I don't remember exactly what it's, you know.
I have it here, but if you'll let me read it.
Yeah,
you say,
please.
Tom Ford wants, and this is a quote, fresh cherry wood licked by a green hot oxygen fire in a Balinese temple.
it's just hogwash, but yeah, I mean, that's what they'd say. And I suppose, you know, that's what they got. I can't imagine what that would smell like.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Gary in Dallas. Hi, Gary.
Hi. I wanted to say that I'm also highly affected by scents, and I've often vomited from very offensive odors. But one of my most memorable remembrance of scent is being woken up by scent. And I understand that's the last scent that's supposed to wake you to develop once you wake up. But I've on several occasions, three or four occasions, I've woken up smelling very fragrant roses. And it's always the same scent, and it's always almost a spiritual thing when I smell them.
Hmm. So you didn't find roses. Someone hadn't bought you roses and put them in the bedroom.
No roses anywhere around.
Hmm.
And it seems to be, I may have been lamenting somebody's death or something prior to that, but I have actually been awakened by the smell of roses before.
That's really interesting, because I know, Bo, that there is sort of a history of people associating the divine with the experience of a rose scent.
Yeah, I was going to say, chalk that up to one of the varieties of religious experience. That's really, I've never heard it, but for sure in the history of scent kind of begins with the holy and an attainment thereof. I mean, the first people to really control scent were priests.
Hmm.
And it was used as a way to convey prayers to heaven or to summon the Buddha and in other religions for other purposes. But, you know, almost universally in all the major religions, there's a very strong scent component.
What does it take to make something that has an odor not give off that odor or to make us not experience that odor?
Oh, yeah. You mean, so in industry terms, that's the difference between fragrance-free and scent-free.
Right.
Fragrance-free means there's no fragrance whatsoever in the product. Scent-free means, could mean, that there is some really disgusting fatty substance in your lotion that would make you want to vomit if you smelled it. So there's, you know, the equivalent of an antimethetic, those things that fight miasmas. There's an odor blocker. There's something that goes in and just blocks that horrible smell. And it creates a neutral smell, no smell at all.
Now, do you, I guess we'll wrap this up with a personal question. Do you use scent in your home? Do you use cologne and that sort of thing? And have your tastes changed since you started looking into this seriously?
Yeah, totally. Roman Kaiser sent me his personal perfume, which was made from the aerial vines of a plant that only exists in the Amazon forest that he found flying in a dirigible over that forest. And he sent me some of that. And I sprayed it on my very favorite person in the entire universe this morning.
Hmm.
I have lots of pets in my house, and they tend to stink. So I burn Nag Champa from time to time. But I also learned that some of these smells are not only to be tolerated, but kind of reveled in, because it's life. That is the smell of life. And what we think is a bad smell or a good smell, you know, really is just a smell. And it's what life smells like.
Bo Friedlander is the author of the article, A Brief History of Scent. You can find it in the August issue of Harper's Magazine. Bo, it's been a pleasure to have you on this hour. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming podcasts and programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org. If you want to email us, it can go to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.